This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww. So anyway, the point is that with this type of study, you can't be certain that you haven't controlled for other factors like... That's him! That's the alien! Kill the alien!
What the...
Are you alright, sir?
What the f*** is going on?
That thing you were talking to was an alien impersonating a human. I'm the real Christopher Labos.
You mean... this whole time I've been doing the podcast with an alien? That explains a lot, actually.
So anyway, I'm here now, and there are going to be some changes around here. Scooch over. We need to change the format of the podcast in a major way.
I don't know if we should be messing with a format that works.
No. Massive changes are necessary in order for the podcast to keep growing.
Okay.
So, first, we're going to have to incorporate interviews into the main episode to break up the pacing a bit. Then we're going to move more topical stuff we used to discuss in the second half of the show to its own episode.
Okay. Well, that's a much less substantive change than you led me to believe initially. Sure, that should be fine.
Good. Now go get some baking soda so we can take care of this alien carcass.
Do you want me to get Teddy?
Who's Teddy?
He's your teddy bear.
I'm a grown man. I don't have a teddy bear.
This is truly a brave new world we've entered. Show about medicine.
Pending FDA approval.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is...
Wait. No, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I wanna say it. I came up with it. It's the body of evidence. It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence, the show that is not afraid of change, no matter how scary it may be.
I'm afraid of both change and spiders.
That voice you just heard is that of my co-host and now certified human, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and apparently alien hunter, just like Chris Pratt.
We're both named Chris. And sitting across from me in our brand new production studio,
which is conspicuously similar to your walk-in closet so we can cut down on the echo,
is Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and audiophile to the point of obsession and pathology.
Right, so today we are trying something a bit different, and you can tell us what you think, or passively aggressively say nothing as you see fit. But we are going to try something a little bit different and revisit one of the first topics we ever discussed on our show.
Vitamins!
Indeed, the billion-dollar vitamin supplement industry that passes itself off as a mom-and-pop operation. We'll be taking a look at the past, we'll talk about how these supplements are regulated, and the two of us will discuss the state of the evidence on the topic of vitamin supplementation to answer the question, should you be taking vitamin supplements? But first, and for the first time since July 2017... our correspondent Thanos Michalopoulos went to Old Montreal to ask people about what they knew and what they thought about vitamins.
Do you take vitamins and any supplements?
Mostly. It's like a new concept for us to take a vitamin pill. We usually get our vitamins from food or
natural stuff. Like if you want vitamin C, you can drink lime water. Like in hot water, you can squeeze a lime.
Hi, this is Thanos Michalopoulos. We are in Montreal in the Old Port. And today we're talking to people about vitamins and supplements.
Well, vitamin D and zinc, it just supports the immune system, and it was more during the pandemic. And I take it also, you know, on a regular basis, like more during the winter.
I was looking up vitamins and maybe things to talk about, and I realized I don't know what any of the vitamins do. Do you guys have any clue? There's like A and there's C and there's D, and then there's like 47 different B's. And I don't know why there's so many different B's. Do you guys have any notion about what's going on?
I have no idea. Aside from the fact that I'm getting vitamin D right now.
But yet you still trust that you're eating enough.
Yeah. I'm pretty certain of it.
You know what? Me too, and I feel like an idiot because of it. I'm like, I've got nothing to back it up. But I'm like, yeah, I think I'm okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I feel okay.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any thoughts? You had mentioned, actually, that you're getting vitamin D right now.
Yeah, so what's contentious about it?
I don't know. Some people say it does nothing. Some people say it's very important, so...
I think it does everything, I think.
I think it does everything.
Being outside is so... I mean, like, I feel like what other... Is there anything else you get from being outside? Because I think being outside makes you feel so much better, and like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's true, but do you think it's the D? I don't know why that's so funny, but
we'll explain it to you later.
Okay, thank you. Are you guys on the ship or?
No.
Well, that's
are you the
that's
captain?
How they found out about vitamins is when they used to, like, Samuel de Champlain, and they travel, and of course they got their beef jerky. Their venison,
yeah.
And then they don't have any other vitamins, and the next thing they're getting rickets. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I had.
Oh, we didn't take our vitamin supplements.
I had a bad case of rickets
You're
once.
Right.
It knocked me right on my ass for a
started
week.
Started growing lemon trees. And
yeah,
on there, and they got their vitamin C.
Yeah. You know, we were just talking about this. That's where the term limey comes from.
Okay.
Is it for an English person? Is it?
English sailor.
An English sailor is a limey. Because they were sucking on lime so that they don't get scurvy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did he get bit by a tick and get Lyme disease?
Okay. Are you going to be at the Comedy Nest later on in the evening? I'd love to come see you perform. Yeah.
How did we solve the mystery of scurvy? You might be surprised to hear that the effort to cure the disease had more to do with geography, politics, and the war with Napoleon. And who better to ask about it than this man?
Stephen Bowne, a nonfiction author of over 10 books, with a special interest in science, and technology, and commerce.
Stephen Bowne is the author of Scurvy, How a Surgeon, a Mariner, and a Gentleman Solved the Greatest Medical Mystery of the Age of Sail. And I guess the first question we need to ask is, why was scurvy the greatest medical mystery of the age of sail?
Well, it was known as the greatest killer, the greatest, destructive force, particularly in the British Navy, but in all navies around the world. And of course, scurvy could appear anytime there was food disruptions during famines or in the winter in northern climates, anywhere there was not fresh food. But it became a serious endemic problem that tied into national security particularly during the later 18th century.
And why did it happen? Namely, a lack of food.
Anytime ships were at sea, obviously they had no fresh food in the age of sail, and a voyage across oceans could take months at a time. So the whole time people were eating dried or, you know, preserved foods or in vinegar, pickled foods, nothing fresh, therefore no vitamin C. And over time, people would develop this horrible affliction that became known as scurvy. It's essentially the body's connective tissue unraveling and...
It really is as bad as it sounds.
Gums all black and their teeth falling out, no open wounds reopening again, and broken bones that had healed the body just starts collapsing.
And being a sailor was something close to a death sentence.
The effects were horrible. I mean, ships could set to sea with, 2,000 mariners crammed onto these tiny ships a few hundred feet long and packed in there, and they would return several months later with, 700 of them dead. And the other one's horribly ill. So it was a severe problem. They always had to factor in like a 25% death rate, probably from scurvy. I mean, during that time, it killed more people than storms and shipwrecks and combat and any other, all the different fevers and diseases and everything else combined. Scurvy outdid them all. So it was a real, real problem.
Now, scurvy wasn't unique to Britain. The Spanish, the French, they all had to deal with scurvy. But there are several factors that made Britain in the 18th century particularly vulnerable to this dreaded disease.
In ancient Mediterranean cultures or empires or, dating back thousands of years, most of those are in a climate that actually produces a large quantity of fresh foods all year round. And ships not being at sea for a huge amount of time, they never would have had that problem. But let's take, for example, Britain. Britain's pretty far north. During the lengthy winter time, there is not a lot of fresh food being grown. So over the winter, people's vitamin C, battery of vitamin C storage would have decreased anyway. And combine this with the fact that a lot of naval voyages began in the spring when the weather was better for departing on these long voyages. So you already had the sailors loading onto the ships right at the point in time when they already had low supplies of vitamin C in their bodies, and then the voyages themselves could last months at a time. And so even though the diet on the ships, you know, sometimes it was horrible, rotten, putrid, salted food that would burn their mouths as they tried to eat it. But other times there was a great deal of quantity of it, but it was all dried. And, months and months at sea in these northern nations, that's what caused the problem.
Britain's northern climate was one thing, but the war and Britain's naval strategy was another factor that made things worse.
If you're England, where are you going to get lemons from? They don't grow in England, and in fact, they would come from the Mediterranean areas, which is areas controlled by your enemies during the war.
Because scurvy wasn't just a medical problem. It was a military problem that was killing the sailors Britain needed to run its navy.
Essentially, that's what it was. Those ships had to stay at sea for months at a time, otherwise the nation would be overwhelmed by a superior military force, and that was, of course, killing them at an unsustainable rate.
Because scurvy wasn't a new problem. But before this time, it wasn't a national emergency. There wasn't the same sense of urgency to find a cure.
The politics of the late 18th century compelled British ships to remain at sea for longer periods of time. And this was particularly in the Napoleonic Wars, ships would be required to set up a naval blockade along the French force. A French coast, where they were trying to keep Napoleon's navy hemmed into a whole series of smaller ports, and to prevent those ships from leaving the ports and congregating into a larger naval mass that could then launch an invasion of England. So the British Navy, for nearly 18 years, was maintaining naval blockades of these French ports, and that involved the ships, although being within sight of the land, to be constantly sailing back and forth in a squadron, making sure that those French ships did not leave port and get together into a larger force capable of challenging the Royal Navy. So it was a matter of national security to keep those ships at sea for longer periods of time. And of course, that's when the cure for scurvy was introduced into the Royal Navy, once it became, imperative for the very survival of the nation to do it.
But identifying a problem is one thing, and solving it is another. And the cure for scurvy wasn't that obvious to people of the time.
It was never a matter of such grave national importance that they would devote the huge resources into it, or that a maverick thinker would rise up through the ranks and try and challenge the accepted medical and scientific orthodoxy that described the nature of disease or the nature of the solutions that could be proposed within that framework. And so, yes, they did lose sailors from scurvy. They did lose ships. I mean, for most of those nations at the time, losing the ship was far more important than losing the sailor. The ships were extraordinarily expensive things. Sailors could be easily replaced. And what shifted in the later 18th century with Britain was that they were running out of sailors at an unsustainable rate. They were running out of ships too, but they, because of the need to have so many of them on the naval blockade, they calculated that they were going to run out of sailors, and they had to find some way of actually preserving them. And that's when they, intensified the efforts to try and sort of break free of the theoretical constraints that had prevented any of the scientific and medical establishments in any of those countries from actually, proposing and accepting a practical cure for this disease. It wasn't until the early 20th century that people actually understood what the different vitamins were. But, in the 18th century, they just wanted a solution to it that was going to stop all their highly trained mariners from dying.
So the story of vitamin C and scurvy is often the story of James Lind, who conducted what is called the first randomized trial in history. But as with most things, the reality is a lot messier and a lot less clear-cut.
Well, I mean, it seems so simple from our modern perspective. Even though it seems so simple, it was actually far more complex to solve at that time within the technology and the mental constraints that people had upon their thinking at the time. There was no scientific theory. James Lind was the first person to sort of begin developing the idea of a scientific theory. So when we think about a theory now, within that context, people say, oh, according to our understanding of things, if we do this, this should happen. So let's design an experiment and test whether that actually plays out in the real world. So then we know if our theory is accurate or not. At the time, in the 18th century, a medical theory, there was no testing of it. They just wrote it up. The more highfalutin it sounded, the more exotic it sounded, the more acceptance it was going to have. The more they appealed to sort of ancient philosophies of the balancing of the four bodily humors, the blood and the bile and the yellow bile and the phlegm, and different things would cause these to become out of balance according to that understanding of the world. And if it was unbalanced, that was the cause of disease, and the cures were attempting to bring these four humors back into balance. And so great, elaborate theories were propounded about how to bring these back into balance and which things should do this and what an acid would do this and a basic thing would do that and how you could blend them and get people back into balance. But it was never tested. There was no way to test these theories. They were just thrown out there and people either accepted them or not. And it was often accepted based on the social status of the person announcing it or how good how persuasive they could be.
For the record, that's not how science works.
So Lind began the process to shift away from that. But he didn't know quite what he had accomplished the first time around and became confused with his thinking as he grew older in time. And so it took these other people, which was James Cook and Gilbert Blane. James Cook, of course, the famous master mariner who sailed all around the world. And famously, one of his most greatest accomplishments was that he didn't have any sailors die of scurvy in the 1770s, despite spending years the voyage lasted years, but they were months at sea, going all across back and around the Pacific Ocean, searching for islands and land that was there. And this was because, you know, scurvy was in the mindset. The British Navy, the British public at that time were very set on trying to find some solution to it. So one of his objectives was to try and test all of these things and see which of them would work. Now, some of the solutions were, you know, we would consider to be totally bonkers. To cure scurvy, the suggestion would be to drink hydrochloric acid or a pint of seawater or smearing mercury paste on open sores, things that make absolutely no sense. But so he actually did a lot of those things, but he also said, we're going to test eating sauerkraut every day. We're going to test this thing that James Lind had thought about, which was he did notice that limes and lemons seemed to cause people to get better from scurvy. So he had spent a lot of time trying to boil down lemon lime juice into a concentrate that could be shipped around on the sailing ships and given to sailors a little bit at a time. Now, of course, he didn't know at the time, but boiling it ends up destroying most of the vital properties of the of vitamin C. That was another, problem.
Well, no one's perfect.
But when James Cook did return, he received his famous award, the Copley Gold Medal for scientific achievement, because he had solved scurvy. Just that he had done everything, and therefore he had no idea which of the things that he had done was effective. So, yes, they knew at that point scurvy could be cured. You could go at months and months at sea, and the mariners would not just immediately die off. But because he had done 20 different things, you didn't know which one was the most effective, just that something he had done was effective.
So as it stands, at this point, things weren't going particularly well, and the Royal Navy didn't really have a cure that it could actually use.
It was Gilbert Blane, a little bit later in time, during the Napoleonic Wars, who was an aristocratic gentleman physician, who, was steeped in the era of the need to find a scurvy cure in order to keep the Royal Navy from running out of men and therefore being invaded by Napoleonic armies. He went back and was reading all of these things, and he read everything that Cook wrote. And then he went back and read James Lind's original treatise, which was from 1756. And he read the original trial that James Lind did upon it. And his reading of that original trial allowed him to hone in on what he believed was the effective ideas that Lind had, rather than the ineffective things which became muddled and confused into the overall general philosophies of the age. And he used his social standing to sort of pound that into the Royal Navy in 1795, just in time, while to keep England from being invaded. So it did require several decades of work by a bunch of different people, each tackling a different part of the problem before they could narrow in on what was going to be the most effective solution that was going to solve their, you know, medical and political problem.
And so we learned an important lesson about teamwork and scientific collaboration, and also why it's important to feed the people who are fighting a war for you.
So if there's like a drug, right, it needs to go through a process with the government before it's okayed. Do you have any concerns about like where you buy the vitamin from when you do it in terms of safety or health or anything? Yeah?
Yep. We do really think, you know, the place from where we are buying, you know, it's giving us a good quality supplement, not that, you know, we don't know what's in it. So we just want to make sure the place from where we are buying, it's a legit place.
So how would you make that choice? I know this is a very vague question, and I'm kind of sorry about that, but how would you know where to go and buy that?
Costco or Walmart, you know, maybe not from any kind of a convenience store, which is a local store. Maybe I have a perception that they're good.
Do you know, like, if these vitamins are safe? Do you know who regulates them?
I don't really... I'm going to, for sure, if someone's going to tell me that, and if I feel like it's a need, I'm going to obviously do my research before I do anything, take anything like that.
Sure.
Yeah, but if it's in a store, like, I'll most probably trust it.
Do you think that they're regulated? Do you think that anything like that is controlled? I mean, and you are allowed to speak as well. It's, you know, we've given women the right to vote, to speak. It's okay now. If you've got opinions,
it's on me. I'm not talking too much. Do you have any? What would you do in that situation?
What?
When you say regulation, you're saying like when they're like these products are marketed or whatever, like.
Yeah, because they're being sold in stores,
yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, again, I don't know what the process is,
yeah.
So I don't know if like the government like makes sure that they're safe or effective or what. Because I know that they have to do that with drugs,
yeah.
But
I think it's the same. You just don't have to go through like the same amount of clinical trials. I think like the FDA would approve it based off of like not like a drug process, but like the same way they'd approve like a food product. Like so, I think so. Does that sound right?
I would take it if it was free.
if you felt like you weren't feeling good, or just like if I had like a bunch of pills in my pocket and I handed them to you,
try one.
You would try one. The yellow one. Yellow sounds fun.
Sure, why not?
So, can you trust that the vitamin supplements you buy at the store really contain what their label says they contain? Do they have to face the same regulation as, let's say, aspirin or cortisone? And what does actor Mel Gibson have to do with this whole process? To answer these questions, I turn to friend of the show and health policy expert Timothy Caulfield. Timothy is the Canada Research Chair in Health, Law, and Policy at the University of Alberta. If you follow him on Twitter, you know he loves to bust myths about health and fitness. So I had to ask him, does he take vitamin supplements?
No. You know, I take absolutely nothing. I don't, and I never have. That's a lie. You know, that's a lie, because when I was a competitive cyclist once, and I for this brief amount of time, you know, I got quite serious, and I said, I'm going to do whatever my coach tells me to do. And so during that brief window, even though I was incredibly skeptical of the efficacy of what I was told to take, I said, I'm going to do what my coach says. It was kind of this personal experiment. And so beyond that, I don't take any supplements.
Vitamin supplements can be found under a wide umbrella called natural health products, or NHPs.
Everything that's not a pharmaceutical or an over-the-counter drug or pharmaceutical that is still being marketed to the public sort of for therapeutic reasons or even for preventative reasons, right? They're making sort of health claims. So that will be vitamins. It'll be supplements more broadly. It'll be herbal remedies. And it'll also be things like homeopathy, which has also fallen under that umbrella.
And while vitamin supplements and your local pharmacy's store brand version of Tylenol might both look like tablets, there's a very important distinction you may not be aware of.
Look, pharmaceuticals and supplements are regulated very differently. And I think that's often forgotten. You know, there is a pretty complex and some would say perhaps even overly onerous regulatory process for pharmaceuticals, which rely heavily on evidence and an assessment of risk. With supplements, it's not the same. You know, the bar, the evidentiary bar in Canada, and you know what I would argue really around the world, is very low. In some jurisdictions, it's non-existent. And they're often regulated as a natural health product. And so what you are seeing on the shelves in Canada and the United States and the UK hasn't undergone the same kind of regulatory scrutiny that a pharmaceutical receives. Even if it's an over-the-counter pharmaceutical, there's just nowhere near the regulatory oversight. And in fact, there's been studies that have shown that the regulatory oversight in countries like Canada and the United States is actually very porous, and there have been lots of problems with the regulatory regime have been identified. But the bottom line is regulated very differently from pharmaceuticals, and the bar is very, very low.
The bar is low, but there is a bar. It's not that there is no oversight. Vitamins and other natural health products do have to show evidence of efficacy, safety, and good manufacturing practices for the final product, but...
So they actually have to demonstrate all those things in order to get what's called a license. But again, really across all three domains, the hurdle is very, very low, and I think particularly with efficacy. They basically can point to anything, as evidence of efficacy. And there have been, in fact, a couple of almost sort of pranks on Health Canada.
Nidon is approved for the relief of fever, pain, and inflammation. We even got a product number. Unbelievable.
Incredibly, everything we need to put our made-up product and claims with no science on the market.
Famously, the CBC got a fake homeopathic product to get a license from the Health Canada by pointing to ridiculously low levels of evidence. And you can do the same with really any supplements.
And as Tim pointed out to me, and this is a topic we have both written about in the past, the scientific and medical literature contains many reports of natural health products either not containing what the label says should be there, or of containing extra ingredients not mentioned on the bottle.
They're often contaminated. They often don't contain what is on the label. There's just so many holes in the existing process that I always say the overall supplements barely regulated in Canada.
South of our border, the situation is very similar, and the loose regulatory framework that applies to vitamin supplements came about in the 1990s. It's called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, or its acronym, DSHEA. And it followed a well-funded lobbying campaign by the supplement industry to make sure their products would not be regulated like drugs. The campaign famously included a TV spot featuring a SWAT team raiding a house at night, only to find a surprised Mel Gibson in a bathrobe holding onto a bottle.
Freeze! Hey, guys, it's only vitamins.
Cut to black, white text on black reads, the federal government is actually considering classifying most vitamins and other supplements as drugs. The FDA has already conducted raids on doctors' offices and health food stores. Could raids on individuals be next?
Vitamin C, like in oranges.
If you don't want to lose your vitamins, make the FDA stop. Call the U.S. Senate and tell them that you want to take your vitamins in peace. If enough of us do that, it'll work.
It did work. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch and Democratic Senator Tom Harkin introduced DSHEA in 1994, and President Bill Clinton then signed it into law. The false framing of the issue had won. Vitamins and other supplements were portrayed as beneficial, natural, and made by noble people, while drugs were seen as toxic, synthetic, and sold by the man. That was, and still is, a false dichotomy.
The reality is, the man is making the supplements too. You're paying the man one way or the other. So if that's your concern, that's not a reason to go to supplements. They're often owned by pharmaceutical companies. And even if they're not owned by pharmaceutical companies, the manufacturers, that is, that it's still a huge industry, right? It's a huge multi-billion-dollar industry that has done a very effective job marketing their product. And when regulators say that they want to raise the bar, the regulatory bar, they have been very, very effective at pushing back. And I know this from, you know, I've had the opportunity to work with regulators and policymakers. And, you know, I hear that. I hear that from politicians. I hear that from bureaucrats. That this is an industry that knows how to lobby. And I think that's one of the reasons that the regulatory hurdles have remained low.
Tim told me he was cautiously optimistic that a stronger oversight for vitamin supplements was possible, especially since the pandemic made it clear that sloppy science and wishful thinking cause real harm. But the momentum needed to enact change can disappear in the blink of an eye, and many stakeholders do not want for these products to be asked to more clearly demonstrate safety and efficacy. Still, the low-hanging fruit when it comes to improving the situation remains making sure that consumers are not misled by marketing.
I think what most people, myself included, want is accurate representations of the value of supplements. And yes, that means that most often it's going to say the supplement doesn't work and you can't make false claims about benefit. There was a very recent, as you probably know, study by the Office of the Auditor General here in Canada, and they found that 88% of the supplements that they did sort of a random analysis of had misleading claims. So at a minimum, we need to fix that so Canadians can make informed choices. But if you look at what happens with supplements, the story is the same every single time. So their observational study that shows promise, right? So correlation, not causation. There's a lot of excitement around it. The observational study is rolled out in headlines and, you know, wellness practitioners as a reason to take these supplements. It becomes sort of embedded in our collective psyche that we're all supposed to be taking this supplement for X, Y, or Z. And then they start to do the good clinical trials. First, they do a little one and, hey, the efficacy doesn't look so good. And then they do a better, more robust clinical trial and turns out there's no efficacy. That's the story that plays out every single time. And unfortunately, often the belief that the supplement is needed or efficacious remains in the public consciousness. And we've seen that with vitamin C. We've seen that even with vitamin E. And of course, we're seeing it with vitamin D. We saw that a lot with vitamin D in the context of COVID. On and on and on. And I think we have to remember that there's that story should inform our skepticism. It doesn't mean we shouldn't research it. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't listen to the debates about the value, the scientifically informed debates about the value of some supplements. But I still think that is an important cautionary tale about supplements.
I don't know why people are so crazy about vitamins. Maybe it's just an easy way to feel that you are healthy.
I usually take vitamins, yeah.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay, when has this been something you've been doing all your life, or and why?
Why? Why not?
I don't know. I mean, okay. there must be, well, I mean, because it's not free, so there must be a good reason, right?
Right, and when you live in a northern climate, there's a lot of vitamin D deficiency.
Wisconsin, right? Do you guys use vitamin supplements at all?
I do not, and I might even be like anti-vitamin supplements.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, why is that?
I feel like you should get it through your food.
Zinc, vitamin D.
Were these something that your doctor recommended, or how did you decide to start taking them?
By listening to a lot of people online at different backgrounds and making my own mind.
You can overdose on A. You can, it's possible,
yeah?
Right?
Yes, okay. Yes. Is it actually a thing?
Yeah. It could be hard on your liver.
Oh. Okay. That, and that, what do you
skin starts turning orange.
Oh, is that what jaundice is?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. Is this personal experience, or you just... Did you go on a vitamin A bender one weekend?
No.
It was the Packers lost, and you're just like, screw it, I'm ODing on A.
And the problems today is like there's so many studies, and you know, and the way studies are made, it's not always easy for the layman to understand and to try to discern if, you know, was the study made the right way? Was it, you know, and by who also? It makes a lot of difference.
So you just kind of take it like as a precaution.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I also go to McDonald's at the same time, so it's like all these contradictions. Sometimes I'm thinking like, why even bother, right?
So yeah, well, you're human, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we just heard from Stephen Bowne about the history of using citrus to prevent scurvy and how that ties to the history of vitamins. We heard from Timothy Caulfield about how the industry is regulated not so well, as it turns out. So here we are now. I'm here with Chris, and we're going to talk about the evidence for vitamins. But first of all, there's just so many different kinds of vitamins. Yeah. And there's all the B vitamins have different numbers, but the other vitamins don't. I'm confused in all of this. So can we just do a quick rundown of what the vitamins are?
Right. So the vitamins are basically named A, B, C, D, E, and K, with various B vitamins, B1, B2, B3, B6, B9, B12. The reason for this nomenclature is a little bit bizarre or historical, depending on your point of view. Basically, back in the day, when they discovered vitamins, they found that there were two types of vitamins. There were fat-soluble vitamins and water-soluble vitamins. And mm-hmm. So the fat-soluble vitamins were called A, and the water-soluble vitamins were called B. And so initially people thought, okay, we have two types of vitamins. And then they realized...
Great. It should have stayed like this.
It should have stayed this. But then they said, well, there were actually different subtypes of the water-soluble vitamins. They said, okay, well, we'll name the first one B1, and we'll name the second one B2, and we'll name the third one B3. And they just kept going. And then they discovered a vitamin that was also water-soluble, but really different than any of the other B vitamins. And they said, well, I guess we'll call this one vitamin C. And then they discovered something else that was a fat-soluble vitamin. They're like, okay, well, we're committed now. I guess this one's D. And they went E and just, you know, continued down the alphabet.
So the ones that are soluble in fat are A, D, E, K,
yes.
ADEC.
Mm-hmm.
And then the B and C vitamins are the ones that are soluble in water.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, here's a question for you.
Yes.
What happened to vitamins F, G, H, I, and J?
Well, we were discussing this before we were recording, so I think I have the answer now. But I didn't know. These are things that were thought to be vitamins initially, and then we discovered that they were not.
Right, or they got renamed, like a vitamin H got renamed as something else. I can't remember now.
Something else.
It became reclassified as one of the B vitamins. No, it was biotin. So vitamin H got reclassified as biotin, one of the B vitamins. Anyway, so there was a lot of fluidity in the naming structure, and so a lot of names of erstwhile vitamins ended up getting reclassified or scrapped when they discovered that they were actually sort of... you know, precursors of other vitamins, or they would get metabolized into other stuff. So we realized they weren't actually distinct entities. They were just sort of along the biochemical chain of production. And so they were really the same thing.
So when you ask, you know, random people on the street, mm-hmm. what is a vitamin? Mm-hmm. I think most people just don't know what it is. It's something that you need.
Yeah.
It's a good thing for your body. But what is the scientific definition of a vitamin?
It is a thing that your body cannot produce on its own. Mm-hmm. Which again gets you into this interesting lanes of trivia, which is vitamin D really a vitamin? Because you can produce it in your body, right? You can produce
from cholesterol.
That's right. When sunlight strikes your skin, you can manufacture vitamin D. So the
little known fact: the vitamin D is not in the sun's rays.
No.
you need the sun's rays to convert
cholesterol
into vitamin D
exactly
in your body.
But the strict definition of a vitamin is something that you have to get from food because your body can't make it. And
okay.
So not everything is a vitamin in every species, because some species can make. For example, I think cats can make vitamin C. So it's
those
not a darn vitamin.
Cats.
It's not a vitamin for cats. They don't need vitamin C in their diet.
All right. So shall we go through all the vitamins?
Yes.
All right. This is going to be great for pub trivia.
Yes, indeed.
So vitamin A,
the
most important one, because it's the first one.
Yes, indeed. First one to be discovered. So here's the thing. A lot of these vitamins can be used to treat or to prevent certain diseases. And vitamin A does actually have a role to play in certain eye diseases, specifically things like xerophthalmia. Not very common and very unusual to be vitamin A deficient in this day and age. But there are situations in which a vitamin A deficiency can cause disease. So, yeah. Have to be a little bit careful about that, but you have to be extra careful about toxicity with vitamin A, because when it comes to the fat-soluble vitamins, if you take an excessive amount, it can build up in your tissue over time and cause problems.
A, D, E, and K.
A, D, E, and K. So can you turn orange if you eat a lot of vitamin A? I don't know if you'll turn orange, but you can get vitamin A toxicity.
So you mentioned orange because A is known as beta-carotene, right?
Yes, yes. Its precursor is beta-carotene. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then you can find it in carrots.
You can find it in carrots.
And there was some propaganda during World War II that has sort of become part of the unspoken knowledge of the world, that people think that it's going to give you night vision, but that was actually propaganda
by the Allies
to make the Germans think that the British soldiers
were just very good at shooting down planes.
Exactly.
But they just had radar.
Exactly.
Now, one thing we have to be careful about with beta-carotene is that one of the studies from quite a while back, now we're talking about 30 years back, but the ATBC study tested to see did beta-carotene actually prevent disease in terms of treating. They were looking at various endpoints, mainly cancer at that point.
They were giving it as a supplement?
As a supplement, beta-carotene supplement. What they found that not only did it not decrease, it actually increased the risk of cancer, mainly in smokers.
Yep.
And so when you talk about harms of vitamins, one of the main ones to think about is that beta-carotene does increase the risk of cancer in smokers. And so that was sort of the beginning of people realizing, oh, when it comes to vitamins, maybe more isn't necessarily better.
Yeah, because they have this health halo around them, and you might go to some wellness websites and tell you can't overdose on vitamins. Vitamins are just good, the more the better. But no, if you're a smoker and you have too much vitamin A, it can actually increase your chance of getting cancer.
Yeah.
Vitamin B1.
Vitamin B1, also known as thiamine. Now, this is something we actually use in medicine quite a bit, actually. We actually give and prescribe thiamine to people. I wouldn't say commonly, but we give it often.
For fun?
Yes. Well, it's fun for us. But when patients are alcoholics, because alcoholic patients can often be thiamine deficient, and they can develop a neurological condition called Wernicke's encephalopathy, which can then progress into Korsakoff's amnesia. So this is a memory problem. And if it's not treated, it can become irreversible. So Wernicke's can progress into Korsakoff's, and Korsakoff's is essentially irreversible at that point.
Yikes. Do we know what the mechanism is that ties alcohol consumption to a vitamin B1 deficiency?
It's just that, well, when the alcohol problem becomes bad, many alcoholics just have developed bad diets.
Oh, I see.
So we often give it... I don't want to say indiscriminately, but where I was like, you know what? This person is a person with alcohol. Just give them. Because it costs virtually nothing, right?
Is it what's in the banana bags, like on ER? They used to...
Sometimes. Okay. We don't use banana bags here. That designation doesn't exist. We often have to prescribe stuff individually. But yes, that's one of the things. Not universal antidotes, but when somebody's like unconscious, you don't know what it is, you would often be like, you know, let's give them you give them some thiamine, you give them some naloxone just in case it's an opioid overdose, because you have a lot of things. So there's a lot of stuff that you do. If you think there's benzodiazepines, you give them flumazenil, which reverses that. So there's a lot of, when you have an unconscious patient, you don't know what's going on, you sort of treat with everything. So we give a lot of thiamine in that respect. So that actually does have medical uses in those contexts.
B2, riboflavin.
Yeah. Riboflavin. There are diseases there are problems that can come up when you're deficient in riboflavin, vitamin B2. You can get like a swelling of your throat and get other sort of irritations of various membranes. We don't see it very much anymore, and there was no specific disease associated with it, but it is technically possible to become deficient in vitamin B2, but we almost never see it clinically.
Vitamin B3.
Yes. So that's niacin. That is also something that we use in medicine, or we used to use it a lot in medicine, not so much anymore. The disease associated with niacin deficiency was called pellagra. Not something that you typically see on a daily basis. But many people, maybe less so now, but go back 20 years, 10, 20 years, a lot of people would have been prescribed niacin because it was a cholesterol treatment. So niacin actually boosts your good cholesterol, your HDL. Mm-hmm. And so for a time, it was being used as a treatment. And it's less used now because there was a big study called Aim High, actually based out of Alberta. I can't remember if it was Calgary or Edmonton now, but based out of Alberta, where they tested and found, it didn't actually make a difference. And this was part of a trend that the idea of raising your good cholesterol wasn't actually a good therapeutic strategy. So niacin was a vitamin that was used quite a bit. Not used so much anymore. The big problem that people had with it was that it would cause flushing. And so people couldn't tolerate it. And they tried like a long-acting form and something with a flushing blocking agent. And it ended up increasing cardiovascular side effects. So the whole... that whole area of research just sort of fell by the wayside. So
and
nice.
We have better cholesterol medication now.
We have better cholesterol medications now, and people really thought it was going to be a promising treatment avenue for a while. It didn't really pan out, and so the number of people who are taking it has really dropped off a cliff in the past few years.
B6
is pyridoxine. It can cause glossitis, so a swelling of your tongue, if you're deficient. Again, we rarely see deficiencies of the B vitamins, right? It's extremely, extremely rare because they are just so common and present in so many different foods. Some of them, like thiamine and niacin, were used clinically, but you know, we don't use them that much anymore.
B9,
probably better known as folic acid. And that's where these...
Which is not benign,
no. This is the other thing, too. The thing that confuses people is a lot of these vitamins have different, not different names, but they have names and they have like numerical designations. And it can become very confusing. Like, most people wouldn't know folic acid as vitamin B9. They would just know it as folic acid.
Right.
That, too, is something that we actually use clinically quite a bit. If somebody is folic acid deficient, you treat them. If you are deficient in folic acid, you can get what's called a macrocytic anemia. Your red blood cells don't form properly and they become bigger and look abnormal under a microscope. Folic acid deficiency is extremely rare in Canada and in most parts of the world because we supplement our food with folic acid for to the point where that most labs now will not run a folic acid level unless it's ordered by a hematologist.
Really?
At one point, because it used to be part of like standard blood work, right? Physicians would just order like all kinds of...
It was always normal.
It was always normal. And they actually, they started sending out letters like 99.999% of all samples we've run over the past 10 years have been normal. So we're not measuring folic acid levels anymore.
Huh.
But it can be an issue. So, and again, folic acid deficiency was a thing. It was a treatment if you had this type of macrocytic anemia. And of course, one of the things that we used folic acid for routinely was to give to pregnant women to treat a condition known as a neural tube defect. So if you're pregnant and you don't...
To treat it or to prevent it?
To prevent it, I guess.
Okay.
To prevent it from happening. So when you're pregnant, if you don't have enough folic acid... the neural tube, basically the sheath around the spine of the baby, doesn't fold in on itself and form a perfect cylinder because the spine starts out as a sheath and it's supposed to curve in on itself and form a round tube.
Mm-hmm.
And when it doesn't close properly, that's called a neural tube defect and it leads to a condition called spinal bifida. Yeah. So the use of that was one of the great campaigns by the March of Dimes, the same people that also led the funding for the polio vaccine because they were the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And so once they got rid of polio, they said, okay, our next thing is to get rid of spina bifida, which they've largely gotten rid of. It's not something that we see very commonly anymore because we routinely give folic acid to pregnant women to make sure they are not deficient.
B12, the vegan vitamin.
B12. So again, another B vitamin. When it is missing, it also, like folic acid, causes a macrocytic anemia. It causes the red blood cells to be too large. People who historically, we used to refer to this as pernicious anemia because it was much harder to treat than iron deficiency anemia. So pernicious anemia... basically is a deficiency of vitamin B12. It can either be due to a intake deficiency or it can be due to the fact that you don't have a specific protein in your body called intrinsic factor, which you need to absorb the vitamin B12. So fun fact, it used because you needed that protein to absorb it from your stomach. For a long time, people thought you needed a B12 injection. And that's how they used to supplement people with B12, a monthly injection. It's almost never done anymore because it's realized if you give people very high doses of vitamin B12 by mouth, they can absorb it anyway and save themselves the injection. So nowadays, most B12 supplementation is done by mouth. If you happen to be deficient, which is not that common, but it does happen, and it produces a similar problem to folic acid deficiency, which is why people used to test for both simultaneously, even though folic acid deficiency is much, much, much rarer because of widespread supplementation.
Vitamin C, which of course we've discussed earlier on the show.
Treats scurvy and not much else.
It's not something that we also see very commonly these
days. No, because we are not British mariners going on long trips. Vitamin C is the one because of, you know, thank you, Linus Pauling, who really thought that and said that it could be used to treat the common cold and, you know, then that's...
And everything.
Cancer and have you. And the reality is, no. I mean, we did talk about vitamin C in previous episodes, but when you actually go and look at the evidence for even vitamin C in the common cold, which is supposedly evidence-based, it's really, really thin. Like, most of the studies are negative, and they're like, oh, it's in high-stress areas. Then you go look at the studies, you're like, so it was positive in It was two studies that were positive in ultra and marathon runners in South Africa. One study in Canadian soldiers who were on military maneuvers in the Arctic.
Yep.
And then one study in children who were at a ski school in the Swiss Alps.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so that's, wait, and they're like, oh, so in like cold and stress. I'm like, yeah, but one of them was in South Africa. That's not cold. And these were marathon runners. Like, yeah, but stress. And you're like, stress? They were at a ski school in the Alps. That actually sounds pretty posh. You know, that doesn't sound very stressful. So it's like, wait a minute. Like, what's the coherent thread behind all of this? And it's sort of like,
There's
false positives. Exactly. It's subgroup. Yeah, exactly. You do a bunch of studies, some by chance end up becoming positive just because of randomness.
Okay, so people probably don't need a vitamin C supplement unless they have a diagnosed vitamin C deficiency, which would be...
It's almost impossible to be vitamin C deficient unless you're a British sailor, because if you're eating fresh food, there's vitamin C
in it. If you're listening to this on the HMS Darlington, this may be of interest to you otherwise.
Also, you have so much vitamin C EU, it takes you months to become deficient. So that's why... We sort of mentioned this in the interview, but it's like, you know, scurvy didn't happen in antiquity because the sea voyages were never long enough.
Right.
And they don't happen now because planes exist. And, you know, so you're never like stuck at sea eating sea rations, dry, rotten sea rations for months at a time. So
scurvy was an era limited problem.
Exactly.
Vitamin D. Oh, we hear about vitamin D all the time.
Yes. I mean, again, there are medical uses to vitamin D. We use it as part of the treatment for osteoporosis along with bisphosphonates and other medications. How much benefit it has is debatable. The evidence is certainly there that it increases bone mineral density. Does it prevent fractures?
Unclear.
I mean, we do it, and I still give it, and I recommend. And until we see evidence to the contrary, I think we continue along the current path because... whatever.
It seems to be, you know, what I see a lot of healthcare professionals do is like, well, the evidence is unclear for vitamin D, but hey, it's cheap.
Yeah.
You're not going to get side effects from like a regular dose. So why don't you take a vitamin D supplement?
Right. And it's part and parcel of the treatment now. It's sort of like calcium and vitamin D and a bisphosphonate. And that really has become standard of care. So until something dislodges that, that is what the consensus is, you know, for good or ill. And so you can't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. And again, it's not as if there's no evidence. It does increase bone mineral density. So presumably it should be helpful, but we acknowledge the doubt.
I've heard a similar argument for giving it to people during the winter who live in more northern latitudes. Unclear, but hey, why not?
I mean, it's a difference when it's part of a medical treatment as opposed to telling people go out and take it. I mean, again, the relative cost is minimal, but you have to be careful because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, it can cause problems. And there was a case very recently of a man who overdosed on vitamin D because he was taking a weekly supply on a daily basis.
I think he forgot to put the decimal in the right place.
That's right. So, I mean... you can overdo it. So you have to be a little bit careful. But there are situations where it's useful. Another one, the vitamin D treatment. Patients who have chronic renal failure, we often give them vitamin D because you need the kidney to produce an enzyme to activate vitamin D from its pro form into its active form. And so patients in renal failure on dialysis don't produce that enzyme. So you have to give them not the regular vitamin D supplement that most people take, but the active metabolite of vitamin D. Because otherwise, they start to lose bone density. Mm-hmm. And they also develop a rise in a hormone called PTH, parathyroid hormone, which starts depleting calcium from the bone and causing bone loss. So
that doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good. And people who have a tumor in their parathyroid gland, who do have high levels of PTH, we also give them vitamin D to suppress that hormone so their bones don't get destroyed.
Vitamin E.
Oh, sorry. Let me backtrack. One quick thing about vitamin D. Multiple studies about it for cancer and heart disease. Studies like Vital. Studies like Amaterasu. Studies like D2D. I wrote a whole article about this called It's Been a Bad Year for Vitamin D. And this was, I think, 2019 or 2020. But it was a bad year for vitamin D then, and there's been a lot of bad years for vitamin D.
Yep.
It doesn't prevent cancer. It doesn't prevent heart disease. It has its limited role in skeletal problems, but not nothing much beyond
that. Don't buy the hype. Vitamin E.
Vitamin E. So very popular for a while, much like vitamin C, but also like vitamin A, potentially harmful. A number of studies have shown that it can increase your risk of having a hemorrhagic stroke. It can increase your risk of dying. Mortality has been higher within the vitamin E arm of certain trials. So not something we should be giving to people, and yet it is commonly included as part of a multivitamin supplement for very, very questionable reasons. No specific disease associated with vitamin E, even though there was a time when people linked it with everything, right. Nerve health and this and that and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So very recently, as we're recording this, some recommendations came out of the USPSTF. What is that?
The USPSTF is the U.S. Protective Services Task Force.
Yeah.
And they emit recommendations on a variety of things, mainly about preventative medicine. And so they put out updated guidelines on multivitamin supplements. And what they said officially was that there is insufficient evidence to recommend vitamin supplements, which is how they phrase it when it doesn't work.
Yeah. They're not going to say don't take supplements.
Yeah.
They're going to say there is insufficient evidence at the moment to recommend.
But they did raise a flag for two vitamins in particular, beta carotene and vitamin E, because of these associations with increased risk. So they did flag those as potentially harmful. But overall, they just reiterated what has been said before. There is no evidence for vitamin supplementation and potential for harms, especially with those specific vitamins in specific groups.
So who should be taking vitamin supplements?
So the short answer is no one. You should not go to the pharmacy and just buy a multivitamin. There's probably no justification for that whatsoever. If you need a specific vitamin supplement at specific times, then there is roles for that. Infants who are exclusively breastfed need vitamin D because vitamin D doesn't get into breast milk, right? Pregnant women get a folic acid supplement. And of course, if you're deficient in vitamins for some reason, so if you're iron deficient, you get iron. If you're B12 deficient, you get B12, obviously. But you're treating a specific problem. You don't have to routinely go out and get it. Especially when especially the water-soluble vitamins like B and C, if you eat normal food, you are not going to be deficient. Vitamin deficiencies are extremely, extremely rare in this day and age, especially if you're living in North America and eat a reasonably well-balanced diet.
So basically, if you're supplementing with a water-soluble vitamin, you're just making expensive pee.
Exactly, yes.
If it's fat-soluble, it may actually accumulate and have some negative effects for you.
Yes, that has happened.
And basically, vitamins make rich people richer?
Yeah, indeed it does. Indeed it does. I mean, they are a product and you're paying, largely it's being produced by a large multinational corporation. So I agree with you. Vitamins make rich people richer.
Vitamins make rich people richer. Vitamins make rich people richer. Vitamins make rich people richer. You have just listened to the pilot episode for a potential reformatting of our show, The Body of Evidence. Leave us your comments on Facebook, Twitter, Patreon, or by email at thebodyofevidence@gmail.com. We want to thank all of our patrons who help make the show a reality, and a special thanks to our $5 a month or more patrons: Alan, Barb, Bill, Brian, Christopher, Craig, Dan, DJA, Don, L, Frank, Jeff, Grace, Ian, Isabel, Islan, Jean-Nicolas, Jeff, Jessica, Joanne, John, Juan, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Laura, Leanne, Leon, Leslie, Louise, Luna, Lindsay, Marianne, Mark, Mary Ellen, Mavis, Mike, Miriam, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Robin, Ronald, Rye, Scott, Sky, That Montreal Guy, Trimian, and Unthor. Thank you to Emil for upping your pledge, and welcome to our newest patrons, Helena, Grace, Rick, and Leslie. Our musical theme and the jingle you heard were composed by Joseph Hackle. You can find his work at josephhackle.bandcamp.com. Our street interviewer was Thanos Michaelopoulos. Our fact checker is Nicholas Koziris. A big thank you to our guests, Stephen R. Bown and Timothy Caulfield. You can support our show either on Patreon or through PayPal. Details at bodyofevidence.ca/about. The Body of Evidence is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. and is not affiliated with the McGill Office of Science and Society. The Body of Evidence will return in September with an episode on Botox, and we will let you know if we stay the course or switch to the format you just heard. Until then, this has been The Body of Evidence on vitamins.